This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And you know, you can listen to The Takeaway anytime by subscribing to our podcast. You can find that on our website, thetakeaway.org, or on iTunes. The Young Woman and the Sea.
We're fishermen.
Sarah Palin of Alaska gives up the ship of her state to sail uncharted waters as a private citizen.
We're fishermen. We know that only dead fish go with the flow.
No going with the flow for Governor Palin, but the GOP's perfect storm does have some explaining to do.
We've just got to put first things first. And first things first, as governor, I love my job and I love Alaska. And it hurts to make this choice, but I'm doing what's best for Alaska, and I have explained why. Though I think of the saying on my parents' refrigerator, a little magnet that says, don't explain, your friends don't need it, and your enemies won't believe you anyway.
With Alaska at her back and that little refrigerator magnet in front of her, Sarah Palin goes off in search of enemies and friends, rough weather or disappearing over the horizon ahead. The forecast on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Monday, July 6th, I'm John Hockenberry. Sarah Palin may claim she can see Russia. Well, we know President Obama can right now. He's in Russia to begin some delicate diplomacy in the U.S.-Russian relationship. Former U.N. Ambassador John Bolton is with us to talk about soft power and Cold War nukes. Also, the agenda for the week with the Marcuses and weddings on the cheap for people who would prefer not to be bankrupt at the altar. Those stories coming up, but first, these headlines. And in the headlines, Alaskan Governor Sarah Palin has been pretty quiet since the resignation announcement on Friday, but she said in a Twitter update yesterday that she's looking forward to joining her family on a commercial fishing trip. Joining us now to talk about the resignation and all things Alaska is Libby Casey, reporter for Alaska Public Radio Network. Libby, good morning.
Good morning.
Are people in Alaska really buying this I'm just a fisherman kind of thing from the now resigning governor?
I think Alaskans are by and large confused about what's happened. There was a lot of speculation she wouldn't run again, but to resign in the middle of her term has taken everyone by surprise. And the best way we're finding out information right now is from her Twitter feed.
And she wants to spend more time with her fish.
Right. Her husband's a commercial fisherman in Bristol Bay, Alaska, and so she was tweeting that she's going to go hang out with them for a day, work out there, go to Western Alaska, and that's actually how we found out where she is.
Twitter, once again, at the crux of history. Libby, stay with us. We're going to get behind some of this confusion in just a moment. In other headlines, President Obama is in Moscow for his meetings with top Russian officials. Right now, he's huddled up with President Dmitry Medvedev. They're thought to be in close agreement that would cut nuclear arsenals for both countries. An announcement is expected today. A federal bankruptcy judge has ruled that General Motors can sell the bulk of its assets to a new government-backed company. In California, 8,000 wristbands await those who get to attend Michael Jackson's memorial service tomorrow in Los Angeles. 1.6 million people entered the lottery for tickets. Nashville police have now classified former NFL player Steve McNair's death as a homicide. He and a female friend were found shot dead in his condo on Saturday. Police have not yet ruled on her death. All major European indices are lower at the moment, and it follows a tough day for Asian markets, too. And Wall Street is indicating a down opening if you look at the futures trading in about an hour and a half. Sarah Palin is out. No one seems to know exactly why. She may be on the hunt for some next big thing. What's it going to be? Run for president like it's rumored? Host a talk show? Be the Republican Party's new Karl Rove? Start a fishing channel? Give Sarah some career advice at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
What do I look like? And I says, well, what do I look like?
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Change your mind, Sarah, Sarah, so easy to look at, so hard to define.
Sarah Palin's decision on Friday, as people were starting their 4th of July weekend, to resign as governor of Alaska produced almost instant reaction within Alaska, and it was something that carried through all weekend long. Here's Sarah Lewis, a resident from the capital, Juneau, in an interview with the Associated Press.
Shock was a big reaction, but then pretty quickly after it, it made some sense to me because she hasn't really seemed to have been focused on our state for a little while in terms of the things we need and what the people are interested in. And then quickly after that, it just kind of dawned on me that really it's been one drama after another.
Indeed, and this is the latest. Joining us to talk about it is Libby Casey, reporter for Alaska Public Radio Network in Washington, D.C. Libby, of course, speaking to us there at the top of the hour. Also, Steve Heimel, reporter for Alaska Public Radio Network in Anchorage. Steve, what are Alaskans saying, first of all, about their reaction to the decision by Governor Palin?
Well, they're they're loving to talk about it. I'm quite shocked, and there's more anger than I expected. Just the ordinary people that I've run into are seem to be kind of upset and calling her a quitter. I'm really surprised.
So anger, not so much anger because she seems to be trying to pull a fast one, or that she's just leaving them in the lurch.
It's kind of, yeah. How dare she?
Right. All right, so Libby Casey and Steve, if you could, together, let's sort out what the reports are saying at this point, what the real reason is for this. I mean, we heard all weekend long about a possible run for the presidency, other political ambitions. Libby, first of all, what do we know up to this point?
Well, all we can do is go to her speech that she referenced being able to make a difference for Alaska from outside the governorship. Now, how that really goes together, we do not know. It certainly seems that she would be able to make the most difference as governor, but she also talked about quote-unquote attacks on her family and wanting to step out of the spotlight and then wanting to work on the national level. What does that mean? We don't know. There are lots of theories out there. I'm curious to hear what Steve's been hearing about people's theories from Anchorage, but down here in Washington, of course there's the question of, will she run for president? Will she come down to the lower 48 and become a type of kingmaker, go around and work the conservative base that loves her so much, where she has that rock star status? She has a book she's going to be working on. What is next for Sarah Palin? We do not know.
Steve?
This consternation here. The way, if you take her words at face value, she said, "It is best to make a difference this summer, and I am willing to change things so that this administration, with its road to an incredible future, can continue without interruption." Now, some of that speech that she made was written out ahead of time, and other parts she improvised into it. If you try and recompress the speech, I think she's trying to say that there has been so much media attention on her that she can afford to leave being governor. I mean, I know this is bizarre, but that she can afford to leave being governor, pursue the things she really cares about, and let the state go on a smoother course under the lieutenant governor, Sean Parnell, that she was not going to run for another term, and if she wasn't going to run for another term, why have all this noise and disruption and sturm and drang and so forth in between now and 2012.
Although if you let those words just kind of settle for a moment and think about them for a second and listen to this from that resignation speech, Steve and Libby, it does seem like she's trying to get out from under something that maybe is going to blow up this summer. Listen.
"I've been accused of all sorts of frivolous ethics violations, such as holding a fish in a photograph or wearing a jacket with a logo on it and answering reporters' questions."
I mean, is she implicitly saying there the frivolous accusations are over and maybe something bigger is coming down the pike?
I don't think so. And the FBI strangely issued a denial saying, "No, we are not investigating Sarah Palin," over the weekend.
So let's listen to one other remark that she made. And this was her describing her situation of running for president. I couldn't tell if it was a positive experience for her or a negative experience for her. Listen to this.
"You don't hear much about the good stuff in the press anymore, though, do you? Some say things changed for me on August 29th last year, the day that John McCain tapped me to be his running mate, and it was an honor to stand beside a true American hero. I say others changed, and let me speak to that for a minute.
Political operatives descended on Alaska last August, digging for dirt. The ethics law that I champion became their weapon of choice over the past 9 months.
I'm assuming some of those political operatists that she's talking about, Libby, are from Washington.
Well, we can, yes. I mean, that is what it sounds like the governor is implying. There have been a lot of ethics complaints against her, and they've been taken apart one by one, and none of them has really stuck. The one thing that she has had to do is pay back travel that for her children. Her children took trips with her in the capacity of governor, and so she's had to pay that money back. But otherwise, the ethics complaints haven't really stuck, and she's had to spend a lot of time and money defending herself.
The question is, why wasn't this speech I won. I beat him. Look at every charge. Frivolous.
Right. Well, I think we have to remember who she is, though, and how she has in the past, what her pattern has been. And she does seem to take these attacks personally. And it seems like the governor does not necessarily separate the personal from the professional. And perhaps that's just because it doesn't feel like they can be separated because they're coming at her from all angles. But there is this, Steve brought up this interesting point that the FBI has said, and they don't usually say things like this, we are not investigating Governor Palin. And that's because there was so much chatter on the blogosphere over the weekend about, you know, what's really going on here. And until things kind of progress, we will not know what really is going on.
John, the timing is totally weird on this.
Yeah.
Nobody can figure out why it was timed the way it was. I mean, I was producing a story when the word came out that a place she was going to be talking on the shore of the lake, you know, like a place that takes an hour to drive to, we got word about an hour and a half before she gave the speech. By the time I found out about it, I couldn't have got there.
Well, let's talk a little bit about whether this is something that plays better in Alaska than it does around the rest of the country. I mean, look, people are independent spirits in Alaska. They go there for their own reasons. They have their own sort of, narratives they want to play out, blah, 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 blah. Is this just Sarah
John,
Palin?
It's playing very poorly here in Alaska.
Really? Really?
Politically, I think you'll discover actually it's probably kind of good for the state. This will calm things down a little bit here, and there's quite a bit of state business that needs to be done, and people need to figure out how they're going to position themselves for the next election. And without her in the picture, it actually, I think it gets a little easier for people to deal with. This has been just plain crazy, this national scale of Palin and whatever her ambitions may be.
Well, Steve Heimel...
And it's also played into everyone's worst fear. Everyone had said there was like this abandonment issue that Alaskans had last fall. Is she going to leave us? Why is she doing all this national stuff? And the governor had said, no, I'm here. I'm dedicated to Alaska. And so now it's like the punch in the gut of like, where is she going?
Well, very quickly, Steve, is there any legacy aside from this craziness for Governor Palin?
I think it's the best possible time for her to leave. She has some scraps of movement on the gas line. The fiscal restraint that she's talking about is probably going to be necessary. There's no real big negatives in the administration that she's had.
Well, so it's a reasonable legacy. Again, she's clouded it with the drama that even Alaskan residents say it's been one drama after another. Libby Casey, finally then, what is the platform? You suggested earlier that the Republican base as a kind of a fundraising superstar would be a place for her to begin. But are we looking at a possible media deal, some sort of Sarah Palin network that possibly is where she lands?
That could certainly happen. You know, I was on Fox News this weekend, and they said to me, is she going to have a TV show? And it was like, why don't you guys tell us? I mean, we do not know. The governor could totally take the media route. And it would sort of be ironic if the group that she's lambasting, she ends up becoming a part of the chatter in class. But she certainly may choose to do that. I think she probably already has a game plan, right? You don't quit your good job if you don't have a game plan. But we do not know. Alaskans do not know yet what is up her sleeve and what she has in store.
Steve, what do you think of Libby being on Fox News over the weekend?
I'm happy.
Yeah, it sounds like she's using the takeaway as kind of like a stepping stone to like greatness here. Libster, that's great. Fantastic.
In Fox World.
Anyway, Libby Casey, reporter for Alaska Public Radio Network, following the Palin mystery, and it really is a mystery, and Steve Heimel for Alaska Public Radio Network in Anchorage. Thanks to both of you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. I'm always loyal to the takeaway.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. Well, you can't always get what you want in this recession. And here to talk about if you're getting married, how to downsize in these hard economic times is Beth Koblaner. She'll be with us in just a moment. We're also talking about Sarah Palin. It's a legitimate mystery. Alaskan reporters can't figure out what she's going to do next. So we're looking for ideas. Should she run for president? Okay, duh, that's a rumor. Join Saturday Night Live as a Tina Fey impersonator. She'd be great as that. Star in the sequel to the movie Fargo.
What do I look like? And I says, well, what do I look like?
Well, she does have the accent for it.
This is Greg from Boston. If you like making fun of Republicans, and who doesn't, then you want Sarah Palin to run every time for anything possible. 2012 will be a fun year.
You settle down, folks. We got John Bolton coming up on the show, all right? I don't want to chase him away. Give Sarah some career advice at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. You can't
always get what you want. Asking for a loan here. You can't always
get what you want. Can I just get two more weeks? You can't always
get what you want. We just need to throw a lot of money at it.
So, here at The Takeaway, the recession is affecting all aspects of life, particularly for people in their 20s and 30s. And joining us now is, of course, Beth Koblaner, personal finance expert and author of Get a Financial Life, Personal Finance in Your 20s and 30s, to talk about what a lot of people in their 20s and 30s are thinking about, getting married. And how do you cut back on weddings? I mean, downsizing weddings, that's something, you know, hippies used to do in the 70s. I remember that, okay? But these days, it could be grounds for divorce. Beth, first of all, how challenging is even coming to the idea of downsizing, particularly considering what we've been through in the last 10, 15 years?
You know, for decades, the bridal industry has encouraged people to spend huge amounts of money for one day. And I think what we're seeing creeping into this whole industry is something called rationality. You know, the average wedding costs right now $22,000. $22,000 for one day.
That's
you can make
average.
A down payment on a home.
Exactly.
Whereas, you know, and it peaked in 2007, it was $28,000. So we're seeing that prices are coming down. People are spending less. And I think, you know, green is the new frugal. People are having green weddings. People are cutting back in all kinds of creative ways. And I think it's incredibly healthy.
What does a green wedding dress symbolize?
It doesn't... Well, it's not actually green.
Oh, okay. Green. Thank you. Great.
It's
well,
not let's talk... actually green.
Let's talk to some people who've actually done this, because I think in many ways, going from $28,000 to $23,000 is incrementally significant, but really people need permission to get way down there. And here, Lainey Doss from South Beach, Florida, where you would expect weddings to go absolutely through the roof, had this success.
It was under $5,000 for 60 people, the whole shebang, everything. And because I kind of had a vision, and the last thing that I wanted was some cookie-cutter wedding, you know, with the normal party favors, you know, the cheesy wedding band. I sort of did everything myself.
How do you accomplish that without having it look like you did everything yourself that morning?
Well, first of all, get rid of the party favors. Where did party favors come from weddings? That's sort of a weird tradition. And these things sort of build on and build on. And, you know, I remember I got married in 1993, June. And in January, I went to some bridal shop and they said, oh, when are you getting married? And I said, June. And they said, oh, 94, 1995. I said, no, this June. They put so much pressure on people to feel like unless you're planning years in advance and you put huge amounts of cost into this kind of thing, then you're going to, you know, have this awful wedding and probably a horrible marriage. So really what people are doing is scaling back, spending. I've spoken to people who spent $1,000 on a wedding, $2,000 on a wedding. They're cutting back on the number of people. family-only weddings. There's a real trend toward, you know, just saying no to big weddings.
Now, what does that mean in terms of the sacrifice? Are you sacrificing the space, pretty much, if you're going down to low four digits, or is it a guest list?
Well, it's both. People are not going to the big fancy hotels. You know, I spoke to one fancy wedding planner in New York who said, you know, even though things have been cutting back, you still have to wait a year in advance in order to get into the fancy hotels, the Pierre, the Waldorf Astoria. I actually called those hotels feigning to be getting married in a few months, and most of them had openings Saturday nights. So there's not as much rush. You could calm down.
You could make a deal.
You could make a deal. Negotiate on everything. If a photographer, you love a photographer, say, could you come without your assistant? Could you only take pictures for 3 hours rather than 5 hours? Instead of AV systems, people are using their iPods. Everybody's cutting back in dramatic ways, not doing paper. There's this whole paperless online invitations now, which are really getting trendy.
Well, Lisa Tornello, also someone who you spoke with, accomplished, again, a wedding for a number of people for under, you know, $28,000. In fact, well under $10,000.
We spent less than $5,000. I think when I was in my 20s, I totally obsessed over my wedding. And when I got to be in my 30s, and I was eventually married at 34, I really thought about what my marriage was. And I was mature enough to take a step back and to think about, you know, what really mattered.
And with that maturity, here's what really mattered.
I love to dance, and we didn't hire a DJ. If we were to do it again, which that'll never be, I would hire a DJ.
So you don't need a band.
You don't need a band.
But you do need a DJ.
You need a DJ, or you need, you know, an iPod. A lot of people are saying they're just doing their own music. And one little tip that I've heard from many people is don't go in there and say bridal, whether you're shopping for shoes or even for a place, because as soon as you say bridal, dollar signs light up in the vendor's eyes. You want to, you know, one woman said, and there's a huge world online of, you know, eBay brides. Everybody talking about, I got my dress for $30, $20. I got it at Target. You know, there's a lot out there. But if you say bridal, a pair of shoes, bridal shoes will cost $250, where a plain old pair of shoes that are pretty much the same thing, $50.
So the lesson, and this conversation continues online on our website, the lesson is project or negotiate on everything. That's
Absolutely.
Number one. And number two, project the value and significance of your wedding in your personal emotional choices, not in the shoes and the party favors. Right?
Absolutely. You know, there are even places you can buy donated gowns now. They take the money you pay for it and give it to charity. That's more in the spirit of, I think, what we're seeing.
And it's all about the spirit, according to Beth Kobliner, personal finance expert and author of Get a Financial Life, Personal Finance in Your 20s and 30s, taking on the issue of weddings. Mark Garrison now has some headlines for us.
Thank you, John. 29 minutes after the hour, 4 NATO troops are dead after a new bombing in Afghanistan. This follows another blast earlier that killed 2. President Obama is in Moscow right now, where he'll focus on reducing nuclear arsenals, among other things. He's meeting with President Dmitry Medvedev and later with Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin. Back in the U.S., Alaska Governor Sarah Palin is speaking out online to respond to what she says are false rumors about her. She's pushing back on Twitter and Facebook. She says she's looking forward to getting away from the speculation about her. Nashville police now say former NFL quarterback Steve McNair was murdered, but they aren't yet classifying the death of the woman found shot beside McNair's body Saturday. They found a gun under her. Police say they're still investigating to find out how they will classify her death and move forward in the investigation. John.
Thank you, Mark.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. The big international news this morning, President Obama and his family are in Russia. president, his wife Michelle, and two daughters walked down a formal reception line on the tarmac a few hours ago, shaking hands with Russian officials. That first event in Russia was symbolic. Also this one, laying a wreath on the Russian Tomb of the Unknowns. But the substantive business is already underway. Meeting with Russian President Dmitry Medvedev. And on the agenda for this summit, which will also include meetings with Vladimir Putin, the prime minister, is strategic and nuclear weapons, how to reduce them, and actually using models for reducing them that come from the Reagan era. Joining us to talk about the Obama administration and how it's projecting itself to Russia and this critical U.S. relationship is Ambassador John Bolton, former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations from 2005 to 2006 and currently with the conservative American Enterprise Institute. Ambassador, good morning.
Good morning.
Now, normally you hammer the assumptions in my question, so let's get that out of the way. Nothing really to quibble with there, right?
Well, I think there's a lot to quibble with there. I think the president goes into these negotiations with a very misguided view of the strategic situation internationally, and particularly the question of America's and Russia's nuclear arsenals. So I think he's pursuing, at least from what he's putting out and what his aides are putting out, a very ideologically motivated agenda to reduce our strategically deployed weapons without even having conducted the appropriate nuclear posture review.
Well, putting the review aside for just a moment, would you support a maintenance of the current levels of strategic nuclear weapons, and where would you aim them?
The purpose of the review is to answer that question. That's why the criticism that he's pursuing an ideological agenda seems to me to be so manifest. You're just picking numbers out of the air until you've reviewed exactly what the circumstances are that we face in the world. And the president himself has said just a few days ago that he wants to look to reduce the number of deployed weapons because he thinks that'll have an influence on North Korea and Iran, which I think is manifestly incorrect. But, you know, he said the idea for us to think that we can grow our nuclear stockpiles, the Russians continue to grow theirs and our allies grow theirs, and that we can pressure these others is wrong. The United States has not been growing its nuclear stockpiles for 25 years, and neither have any of the allies that I know about, Britain and France, unless we've counted a few more in there. It is true the Russians are growing theirs, but that's not a problem. That's not something that that influences Iran and North Korea.
Well, isn't a more cooperative arrangement with the United States, between the United States and Russia, doesn't that have leverage in the region, in Afghanistan? There's already an agreement to actually share a territory in bringing military materiel to the Afghan theater. Doesn't that produce some sort of leverage in Afghanistan or with Iran?
The only thing the Russians have granted there is limited overflight rights that have not been spelled out exactly to bring materials to the coalition forces in Afghanistan. It's a very limited concession since most of what we ship there, we ship through our bases in Western Europe and the Middle East already. We don't need overflights from Russia. But the real issue, I think, is this determination to reach an agreement with a much less significant Russia that will, in fact, reduce America's global nuclear umbrella. Remember, the Russians don't have any allies that they protect with their nuclear weapons. We have our NATO allies. We have Japan, Australia, and a range of others around the world. Shrinking our nuclear umbrella actually lessens security for many of our friends around the world.
Is that how they view it? Is there a global consensus among Western allies that the U.S. needs to maintain its nuclear arsenal? That's certainly the first I've heard of that.
There's certainly no pressure that I'm aware of from the Europeans to reduce the arsenal. And in Japan, if anything, the conversation, because of the threat from North Korea and growing concern about China, really now is on the issue whether Japan itself will become a nuclear power, something I think we should try and avoid. But I think you've got to come back to the fundamental point that we haven't heard in some number of years what the actual nuclear posture review has shown. And to me, that's a real failing in the administration strategy. You said at the beginning, well, let's put the study aside. You can't put the study aside. That's why we do the study.
Well, I just wanted to put it aside for the purposes of this conversation. But
my point is you can put it aside and have an intelligent discussion about the subject.
Well, then let's just talk about the status quo. I mean, isn't there an implicit trust in maintaining the status quo in that we believe somehow, without actually any leverage on Russia, that they won't end up delivering or somehow losing nuclear weapons into the hands of nations that would actually use them against the West?
Well, we have programs. We've had cooperation with Russia for nearly 20 years to prevent their own weapons.
Yeah, but as you just said, the numbers are going up.
No, I did not say that.
You just said the numbers of Russian warheads is going up.
The modernizing of the Russian strategic nuclear capability is undoubtedly going on, not because they're increasing their warheads, but they're increasing their delivery systems. And the point is they are engaged in this kind of activity in connection with a variety of other belligerent behaviors, such as threatening Western Europe with cutting off oil and natural gas supplies, invading Georgia last August, providing protective cover for Iran in the Security Council, and interfering generally in the Middle East.
Finally, the Obama administration has said nonproliferation is one of the goals of nuclear reductions between the U.S. and the Russians. Do you think nonproliferation is a worthy goal here?
Nonproliferation is a critical goal. Reducing America's nuclear arsenal will have zero impact on the mullahs in Tehran and their quest for deliverable nuclear weapons. And if it's possible to have less than a zero impact, that's the impact it will have on Pyongyang. Pulling our numbers down does not convince the rogue states and terrorist groups that want nuclear weapons to give up their quest for that capability.
Ambassador John Bolton, the former ambassador to the United Nations from 2005 and 2006, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Ambassador Bolton spoke from his home in Bethesda, Maryland. Mark Garrison is now here with the headlines.
Thank you, John. 21 minutes before the hour, and Alaska Governor Sarah Palin tells fans not to listen to speculation about her surprise resignation announcement on Friday. She's taking to Twitter to defend her choice and urge followers to ignore critics. Over in the lower 48 states, General Motors now has the go-ahead to sell its assets to a new government-backed company. A bankruptcy judge approved the plan late last night. The government hopes to close the deal on Thursday, but the decision could still be
I don't understand that. General Motors is going to sell what it's valuable to another company. That won't be General Motors?
Well, the other company is essentially the U.S. government and the unions. And so the U.S. government, I think, has a 60% stake. The unions have another stake like that. So they, you know,
But so GM's just like a health care company that –
Some people say it's been that for a long time,
but the
headline is the bankruptcy plan. The plan they had to reorganize their bankruptcy, that's approved.
I got approved last night. So. I'm interrupting you.
Yeah, that's fine. In California, the 8,000-plus winners of tickets to Michael Jackson's memorial service in L.A. pick up their wristbands today.
8,000 out of 1.6
million. So a few disappointed people out there. Police are telling them if you don't have a ticket, please don't show up tomorrow because it's going to be crowded. And then looking overseas, exiled Honduran President Manuel Zelaya says he will try again to come back to Honduras. The military blocked him yesterday.
That's a tense standoff. Thank you, Mark.
You got it.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
Third down at 5. McNair looking over the middle.
Everything's outside.
Looking to run. Now steps back. Rolls left. Rolls right. In bad trouble. Back at the 40. He gets away somehow. Fires downfield. There's Dyson. Dyson at the 10.
Ball timeout.
He's tackled at the 10.
There's a clip from Super Bowl 34 at the Georgia Dome in Atlanta. Steve McNair, the star of that game, some would say the star of one of the best Super Bowls that ever was played, had some tragic news over the holiday weekend. He was found shot to death on Independence Day. Police ruled it yesterday as a homicide. It's still not clear what exactly happened with the shooting. We want to take a look at what this means for the NFL and for McNair's legacy, what of it exists. Ibrahim Abdelmateen's Takeaway sports contributor right here in the studio. So this is a horrible end to really a career that was untainted by a lot of the drama that we've read and talked so much about in the NFL, star players getting into brutal, difficult sort of low-life situations.
It's true.
He was a small town kid. He came from Mount Olive, Mississippi, which is population 1,000. He came from a small time college at Alcorn State, but he still was competing for the Heisman. And he still dies of gun violence, which affects so many black men in this country.
What is the legacy here? I mean, do we put McNair's death in with these other stories of violence and brutality that the have dogged the NFL really for a half decade or more? Or is this some terrible wrong turn that, you know, sets him apart somehow?
You know, the way it's coming down, it sounds like a case of domestic violence. They're calling it a murder-suicide. The way that it's that's the way the investigation is evolving. But I think you do put it into that larger pool of stories of the American narrative that says that it's dangerous out there, and particularly for young black men that are no matter where they come from and where they're going, that it's a difficult world that they're living in.
Well, it's just to grab some of the details. I mean, his body was found 2 bullets in the head, 2 bullets in the chest, I believe. A woman's body was found nearby. The gun was found nearer to her body than his. She had 1 bullet wound to the head. Cops aren't saying what happened, but they aren't investigating, which suggests that the circumstances pretty much tell the tale.
Yeah, they call it they've already declared his death a homicide, and they have yet to declare her death. So we'll see what happens. All the details will come out. And I think all the details about his marriage and the state that was in. And
this woman
children.
Was not his wife.
Correct.
And there's no indication that she even knew of this relationship. They were at a house that McNair and a friend jointly rented.
Correct.
Right.
So, yeah, I think it's a tragic thing. The thing about Stephen McNair, there's a lot of black quarterbacks that came before him. Randall Cunningham, Warren Moon, mm-hmm. Doug Williams. But Steve McNair was one of the first black quarterbacks that was drafted out of college, and they said to him, basically, you're going to be the guy. You are the face of this franchise. And he was the first in that sense for a black quarterback.
And, you know, unlike a Warren Moon, who in many ways couldn't take that pressure, McNair did.
People looked up to him he was the guy in the huddle that, and in the critical moment in the game that you looked to McNair, and he actually looked up to Warren Moon, which is one of the sad things about this, is that he had his role models. He was a soft-spoken leader, but he made things happen when it mattered. And everyone described him as tough, indestructible. They called him a Superman.
Tough life after the NFL. That is for sure the story here.
Definitely.
Ibrahim Abdelmateen, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining the practice of renting dogs to people who desire canine companionship when visiting a new city. Who does it really comfort, and who does it exploit? Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, I'm John Hockenberry. Coming up, the agenda with the two Marcuses. We'll talk about what's ahead, and we're also asking Sarah Palin, what's next for her?
Hey, Troy Cohen from North Dakota. Recent death of pitchman Billy Mays combined with Palin's resignation. Coinky dink? I think not. She's going to come up with a fish smell removing product so revolutionary that, gosh darn it, you'll want to pinch yourself.
Troy, overthinking it again. 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Mark Garrison has our headlines.
Amen. 12 minutes before the hour, President Obama is in Moscow right now. Meetings today with Russian President Dmitry Medvedev. A prime focus is nuclear arms control. A clear road ahead for General Motors' plan to climb out of bankruptcy. A judge is giving the okay to GM's restructuring plan in a new ruling just out late last night. 4 NATO troops are dead after another bombing in Afghanistan. This follows another deadly blast earlier today in the south. Ousted Honduran President Manuel Zelaya now vows to try again after coup plotters blocked his plane from landing in Honduras. At least 2 are dead in clashes between security forces and Zelaya supporters. And Switzerland's Roger Federer defeated American Andy Roddick yesterday to win Wimbledon. That makes 15 Grand Slam titles for Federer, which is a record. John?
And just crossing, the Associated Press says former Defense Secretary Robert McNamara has died. Thank you, Mark.
Our government.
Healthcare.
Your government.
The economy.
Bailout.
Global financial recession.
Transportation.
Agenda.
Agenda.
The work that needs to be done.
What's going on? What's going on? What's going on? What's going on? Yeah, what's
Good morning, everybody. It's time for the agenda. What are the stories that are going to set the tone for this week? Lots to talk about. And with us, of course, Marcus Mabry, international business editor for The New York Times, right here in the studio. And from Moscow, where Barack Obama is beginning this morning a visit to Moscow and a summit with President Medvedev and even a conversation with Prime Minister Vladimir Putin, is Jonathan Marcus, BBC diplomatic correspondent. Jonathan, good morning to you.
Yes, good morning.
So, first of all, let's talk about what's likely to happen. What is on tap in Moscow? And is the bar high? Is Obama being tested, really, in these very first meetings with the leadership in Russia?
I think this is a huge test for the president's foreign policy. This is the first. He's obviously met his Russian counterpart briefly once before in London, but this is the first major summit meeting of the presidency. And it's interesting because the newspapers here, commentators here, are all really being rather cautious, setting rather low expectations of what's going to come out of the summit. Tomorrow he'll meet with the former president, currently Prime Minister Vladimir Putin, who many see as still the guiding hand, certainly behind defense and foreign and strategic policy. Two things we're expecting concrete from this summit. One is a draft agreement on where the arms control negotiations have got to and where they need to get to by the end of the year when the START treaty expires. We think that's pretty well in the bag, we're not sure. Also, importantly, an agreement from the Russians to allow US troops and military supplies to fly through Russian airspace to Afghanistan. So two concrete things there. And obviously, President Obama will be hoping that that can provide the platform or the basis from which to build a much more substantive and positive relationship between the United States and Russia.
Marcus Mabry here in New York. I can't imagine that Barack Obama is going to come back from Moscow hailing the restart of the START treaty as some sort of political platform to rouse American support. He's got to be taking a whole different approach here.
Well, it's going to be interesting because, of course, John, this is a week of international travel where this Russian trip is actually, by the end of the week, going to seem like a distant memory to most of your listeners because he's going to go from here to the G8 summit in Italy where you're going to have global warming on the agenda. That's going to be a huge goal. He'll actually be chairing a global warming meeting, and then he's off to Africa.
All right, listen to what former ambassador to the United Nations John Bolton said about the very low expectations in his view of this particular meeting between Obama and the Russians.
Nonproliferation is a critical goal. Reducing America's nuclear arsenal will have zero impact on the mullahs in Tehran and their quest for deliverable nuclear weapons. And if it's possible to have less than a zero impact, that's the impact it will have on Pyongyang.
Of course, former Bush administration official John Bolton. Is there anything to that there? And certainly we've seen the Obama administration focusing on regional issues, that this meeting in Moscow is more about influencing Iran and possibly the situation in Afghanistan, where there's a big offensive going on right now, Marcus.
Well, those are absolutely true. Those regional issues are key, and I think that's perhaps what former Ambassador Bolton was referring to, but by the same token, I think he also overstates the case. The nuclear posture of these two nations, who are still the two largest nuclear armed countries in the world, is still crucially important. Not in the short term, ironically enough, but in the long term, very important. So he actually overstated the lack of importance here. But yes, those regional issues and Russian cooperation, particularly as regards Iran, will be crucially important as well.
Jonathan Marcus, what do you think of what Ambassador Bolton was saying there? Less than zero or zero impact on Iran and North Korea, whatever goes on in Moscow today?
I think that probably is true in the narrow sense. I think, though, clearly in terms of bolstering the non-proliferation regime, ensuring that it continues into the future, and as many analysts say, it needs to be strengthened, I think to do that, part of the answer is for the US and Russia to show that they are serious about further nuclear cuts themselves. So I think there is an important sort of incidental impact. I think the wider problem with this summit is that you have a meeting essentially of two very different powers. The Russians in the run-up to this summit have been arguing very strongly that this is the moment to show that they are the equals of the United States, regaining lost pride and so on. I mean, it's clear to everyone that when Mr. Obama walks into the same room as Mr. Medvedev, you do not have representatives from two countries who really are at parity. The United States, for all the problems of recent months in the financial sector, the problems in Afghanistan and Iraq, is still the only remaining superpower. For the Russians, it's important to talk about arms control because that's the one area where they can sit at the table with the Americans as equals. But, you know, it's going to be hard to see what the Russians are really going to be willing to give to the United States on crucial things like bringing pressure to bear on Iran and so on. I think the Americans will bank what they can from this summit, but I think they'll be willing to walk away from the relationship with Russia to reduce the importance of the relationship with Russia if Moscow isn't going to be sufficiently forthcoming.
Well, it's fairly clear that the president isn't going to hear remarks like this from anybody he speaks with in Moscow today.
He's my mentor, he's my father in spirit, and he's my everything. I love him, and I love him so much, and I'll continue to love him.
That's Adua from Poma, who's a Ghanaian citizen, speaking about the election of Barack Obama back in November. When the president travels to Ghana this week, there will be an important, and you've already sort of alluded to it, emotional moment for both the president and for the entire continent of Africa.
Oh, I think so. This is going to be, you know, extraordinary. And there's ironically no kind of formal, mass, you know, speech planned for the Ghana trip.
And he's already been to Africa. He was in Cairo. Cairo is in Africa.
Yes, it is. It's not sub-Saharan Africa. And I think in this case, I think it will make a difference. I usually am very much for keeping Egypt in Africa, which is where it is located geographically.
Right.
But in this case, I think it's going to make a great difference that you have the son of a Kenyan who is going to be, you know,
right,
President of the United States, who's going to be speaking in Africa. I think it's going to be a real salve for the president. I think he's going to need it by the end of the week.
Right.
I think you're going to see lots of images from the G8 summit, which is normally, of course, the eight largest industrial economies in the world. Now you might call them the eight most hobbled, you know, economies
right
in the world.
So meeting in seclusion in Italy,
exactly,
right, where Berlusconi is in a bunker of his own.
Exactly. In L'Aquila, which is, you know, a former, very recently an earthquake site. And that is a fitting, symbolism probably for the global economy.
Well, the global economy will also be watching General Motors, which may take another step towards emerging from bankruptcy with the agreement that came overnight. It can be appealed. We shall see. As far as the G8 summit is concerned, again, Jonathan, I'm sure you have something to say about that, but I have to go out with both of you. Will we be talking about Sarah Palin by the end of the week, Marcus Mabry?
I think we will continue to talk about Sarah Palin by the end of the week. Michael Jackson will eclipse her completely on Tuesday.
Sure.
When his funeral becomes a global news event again, he takes over the news programs. However, by the end of the week, we'll probably have some more indication about what her plans are, and I think they are actually to gather chits and pursue a run for the presidency later.
Jonathan, I don't want to pull you out of your expertise, but in the tabs in London, as you're away in Moscow, what's the headline going to be? Michael Jackson or Sarah Palin?
Certainly Michael Jackson, but amongst the chattering classes, I think there'll be a certain amount of grim horror at the thought of the former Alaska governor, present governor, moving perhaps further into American politics.
Well, when he's not the BBC's diplomatic correspondent, he covers pop culture for us. Jonathan Marcus, thank you very much. Marcus Mabry, the international business editor for our partners, the New York Times. There's your agenda, folks. Of course, also in the news, we're following the Alaskan Governor Sarah Palin story. She'll be stepping down officially on July 26th. What's the next big thing?
She probably already has a game plan, right? You don't quit your good job if you don't have a game plan. But we do not know, Alaskans do not know yet, what is up her sleeve and what she has in store.
Plan B for Sarah Palin, Alaska Public Radio's Libby Casey has your takeaway there. We're looking for ideas of what that plan B might be. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
With possible serious implications for the global recession, Alaska Governor Sarah Palin discovers a new meaning for the word quitter. Let's see if we can follow it.
And though it may be tempting and more comfortable to just kind of keep your head down and plod along and appease those who are demanding, hey, just sit down and shut up.
Okay, so staying with the program, hunkering down, keeping your job as governor would be quitting?
But that's a worthless, easy path out. That's the quitter's way out. And I think a problem in our country today is apathy.
Quitting means not quitting your job. The problem of apathy? How would she deal with the problem of literacy? Sarah Palin says goodbye to one job and hints about another one. Available for part-time work as leader. Must share full-time responsibilities as drama queen in chief. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry, hoping you had a good 4th of July weekend. Fireworks from Alaska, eh? The Palin story broke on Friday. We'll see what Alaskans are thinking this morning. A new relationship in Russia. America's top career diplomat, Thomas Pickering, is joining us. History at Wimbledon and what's for lunch in Baltimore. Fresh arugula for school lunches. Those stories coming up, but first these headlines. In the headlines, Alaskan Governor Sarah Palin says she's ready to join her family for some fishing, according to her latest Twitter update. That's after a weekend of speculation on her resignation. The Twitter update is the only real news we have from the Palin camp since her resignation announcement on Friday. Joining us now, Gail Collins of the New York Times. Gail, here we go again talking about U.S. governors. Is the Palin legacy going to be trying to define not quitting your job as quitting?
Well, you know, those wacky governors we've got now, that, you know, you want them to resign, they won't go away. If you don't, there they are.
Does she have a future?
She's got a future running around making speeches, that's for sure.
And Gail, we'll be back with you to explore that future. The Palin resignation, of course, the big story on Friday, and where she stands up now in the fast-falling GOP presidential hopefuls. In other headlines, former Defense Secretary Robert McNamara has died. According to the Washington Post, McNamara served under Presidents Kennedy and Johnson from 1961 to 1968. And he later went on to serve as president of the World Bank. He was 93. President Obama is in Moscow for talks with Russian leaders. Russian President Dmitry Medvedev is first on his list. Trimming nuclear arsenals tops the agenda. A federal bankruptcy judge has ruled that General Motors can sell the bulk of its assets to a new government-backed company. It's all part of the complicated restructuring of GM. Nashville police have now classified former NFL player Steve McNair's death as a homicide. He and a female friend were found shot dead in his condo on Saturday. Police have not yet declared whether her death was a murder. In international news, ousted Honduran President Manuel Zelaya is back in El Salvador after the opposition government kept his plane from landing in Honduras. He will reportedly try again. All major European indices are down at least 1% right now, and the losses look likely to continue on Wall Street. Futures suggest a down opening when trading begins in less than a half an hour. Sarah Palin is out. What's her plan B?
Hi, this is Bill from Sterling Heights. I have a perfect job for Sarah Palin, WNBA coach. I think she'd do really well with this. She has a great understanding of the role of a point guard, and I think she could build a good team.
Now, that's the first responsible suggestion from our listeners yet. Should she run for president or just be a WNBA coach? 8778-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. So last Friday, when America was putting its beer and burgers on ice, and perhaps some Takeaway listeners were putting their veggie shakes and tofu on ice for the 4th of July weekend, the shocking news came from Sarah Palin. The governor of Alaska decided that she is resigning by the end of this month to pursue something she really didn't explain. Now, some people in the mainstream media might call that the gift that keeps on giving, but we're not all cynical here. Listen to Palin herself.
I think a problem in our country today is apathy. It would be apathetic to just kind of hunker down and go with the flow. We're fishermen. We know that only dead fish go with the flow. No productive, fulfilled people determine where to put their efforts, choosing to wisely utilize precious time to build up.
Well, we're going to utilize our precious time deconstructing Sarah Palin's speech from last Friday with Gail Collins, columnist for our partners, the New York Times, who's spoken to us on a number of occasions about, shall we say, erratic, eccentric governors in the U.S. We were talking a little bit ago about this idea of not quitting as quitting, which was only one of the linguistic acrobatics that she introduced in her speech on Friday. But when Sarah Palin was announced as John McCain's running mate, Gail, last summer, she was immediately this kind of mysterious feminist figure with an enormous amount of potential, all of a sudden, which she almost immediately didn't realize. But after last Friday, does it seem like she's really moving towards being a laughingstock?
The kind of speech she gave when she resigned was the kind of speech that you expect somebody to give when they're kind of ad-libbing desperately trying to make sense. But somebody wrote that speech. Someone wrote that all down, and she read it and said, yes, this is exactly what I want to communicate with the people of Alaska. That part of it is kind of scary.
Well, some of the Alaska Public Radio Network reporters we talked to earlier said that it was a hybrid. It was part of it was written out, part of it was ad-libbed. Maybe the refrigerator magnet part was something she threw in there at the end. I mean, it did sound like she was delivering lines for Katie Couric, and Katie Couric wasn't there to interview her. I mean, every single one of the lines was a head-scratcher.
I was wondering this morning, if Barack Obama's in Russia, can he see Sarah Palin's house?
Well, he can see Russia. We know he can see Russia, that's for sure. Maybe that's something they have in common. Is there a future for Sarah Palin? A lot of people over the weekend on some of the talk shows were suggesting that if she can't stand this kind of heat, she has no political future.
Well, I think she does want to make some money. They have apparently got a lot of legal bills. And that Mike Huckabee seems to be extremely happy having a program on Fox and interviewing American Idol candidates and doing health tips with the Jazzercise ladies and stuff. So maybe that's where she's going.
I mean, is that the new platform whereby you bide your time, hope for presumably mistakes on the part of the Obama administration, or that the economy doesn't turn up again and then show up again in 2012?
That's never happened before. To me, the weird thing here is there's Mitt Romney, and just sort of sitting there as everybody crashes and burns all around him, just sort of waiting and smiling and showing up every Sunday on somebody's show and being rich. I mean, he's a happy guy right now.
Well, we certainly have no particular reason to believe that a major media deal isn't in the works for Sarah Palin. But, compared with how she described what she called a lame duck governorship, any media deal would be preferable. Listen to this, Gail.
I thought about, how much fun some governors have as lame ducks. They maybe travel around their state, travel to other states, maybe take their overseas international trade missions. So many politicians do that. And then I thought, that's what's wrong. Many just accept that lame duck status, and they hit the road, they draw a paycheck, they kind of milk it. And I'm not going to put Alaskans through that.
So she's not going to milk that, but presumably she is going to milk something here.
No, and I noticed that even in her speech, she was talking about how she's been going around to the various overseas bases and talking to the troops and things like that. So apparently that doesn't count as part of the strange things you do when you're a lame duck.
I don't want to put you necessarily in this position, but I remember last summer all of the discussions about what a complex reaction women were having to the ascension of Sarah Palin, and then that sort of went away. Is there any sort of complex reaction that women are having to what Sarah Palin is doing now?
I think women have gotten over the complex reaction period for Sarah Palin. She is what she is. And the nice thing on the woman front, I got to say, is that there are now so many women in very high positions in government that you no longer think if one of them is running around making a fool of themselves, that it's going to make the whole sex look bad.
Maybe that's the best takeaway of all here, that there is diversity within the enormous number of women in high office in the Obama administration and politically generally in the United States. Gail Collins, thanks so much.
Anytime.
Columnist for the New York Times talking about Sarah Palin's resignation. She announced it last Friday, and we've had the entire 4th of July weekend to digest it. So President and his family touched down in Moscow a little over an hour ago. The president first went to a wreath-laying ceremony at the Russian Tomb of the Unknowns. 15 minutes ago. He sat down with Russian President Dmitry Medvedev. High on the agenda is reducing the number of strategic and other nuclear weapons. But the model is one from the old START treaty, which really came out of the Reagan era. Joining us now is the New York Times' Clifford Levy from Moscow. Good morning, Clifford. And, you know, there are two real big stories here. One is, does this nuclear proliferation issue, the reduction of nuclear weapons, is this the kind of thing that's going to have political significance around the world, or is it really more arcane? And secondly, what do the Russian people think about this man who's gone virtually everywhere else in the world to enormous crowds?
Well, I think they're looking at this on two different levels. On one level, they're hoping that if the Obama administration hopes that if they can reach an agreement with the Kremlin on arms control, it can act as a kind of a catalyst in a whole host of other areas, whether it's North Korea or Iran or Afghanistan or terrorism. So that's kind of one front. And they're also hoping it kind of sets an example for nuclear reduction in other places, whether it's, again, Iran or North Korea. In terms of how the Russian people are reacting to Obama, that's a fairly interesting area at this point. There's a bit of hopefulness that we've detected lately, both in the Russian government and among the Russian people. It's quite interesting. Over the weekend, for example, the Russian TV quite prominently showed President Medvedev wishing the United States Happy Independence Day. They also, the Russian TV, for example, ran a long segment on the opening of the viewing area in the Statue of Liberty. So it seemed to me that they were setting the ground to some extent for hopefully what would be a positive summit.
You know, I want to alert people to your piece in the New York Times this morning, Six Ways to Decode Russia. It actually, I think it has this sort of try this at home quality that the crossword puzzle, I think, attempts to do every single day. I don't want to go through the decoding, but I do want to remind people that it's on the front page of the paper. Let's talk a little bit about this assumption that the Obama visit really is projecting diplomatically. I mean, he's claiming that Obama and Medvedev's talks are going to be able to go from discussions about nuclear reductions on the old START model and go immediately to suddenly we have the ability to cooperate and change things in Iran and Afghanistan. Is that a reasonable agenda, and can he actually make that transition?
Well, obviously, it's a very complicated agenda, but what I think they're hoping is to first to try to change some of the tone here. Things soured so much toward the end of the Bush administration that essentially the two sides pretty much gave up on each other. So, you know, the phrase, it's become almost a cliche that the Obama administration has been using as a kind of this reset of relations. And they're hoping to sort of take it step by step. You know, Medvedev and Obama met in London in April at the G8 meeting, and they had a fairly good talk there. And they both spoke afterwards quite positively about one another. And now they're sort of hoping to take it to the next stage here. Now, of course, you know, the one interesting aspect of this summit is that Medvedev, you know, to some extent, is not the real leader of Russia. It's Vladimir Putin, who's
right.
The prime minister and the man who essentially installed Mr. Medvedev. So Obama is in this awkward situation where he has to meet and negotiate with Medvedev because Medvedev is officially occupies the highest office in the land. But at the same time, Obama also has to find a way to reach out to Putin. And in fact, tomorrow, Obama and Putin are having breakfast together. So it's a very complicated situation that Obama has to navigate.
Obama has to explain this statement that he made that Putin has one foot in the Cold War way of doing things and one foot out of it. Do you think the resolution of that apparent contradiction will raise Putin's status here?
You know, it's funny. Putin can be very sharp, very quick with the tart retort when he's criticized. He's very clever on this. And on Friday, the day after Obama made that comment, Putin, of course, was asked about it, and he kind of finessed the whole thing.
So
it looked like he didn't really want to engage on it.
Looking for common ground. We'll leave it there. But interesting stuff. The Putin meeting is probably what to watch for. Clifford Levy, New York Times Moscow bureau chief.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. We begin this segment with a meeting both substantive and symbolic. President Obama and his entire family touched down in Moscow earlier this morning. The president sat down with his Russian counterpart, President Dmitry Medvedev, and this is his first fledged summit since 2002, when President Bush famously looked into then-President Vladimir Putin's eyes and saw his soul. That was the allegation, anyway. This time around, the White House is stressing other goals, leading with soft power, leading with diplomatic tools in world affairs. That's part of what this meeting is all about, but also using leverage with the possibility of a cooperative arrangement between the U.S. and Russia, having an impact on things in Iran and Afghanistan. To see whether that's possible, we turn now to Thomas Pickering, former U.S. ambassador to Russia from 1989 to 1992. Under George H.W. Bush, he's currently co-chair of the International Crisis Group. Ambassador Pickering, good morning.
Good morning, John.
Let's talk first about the model that these two leaders apparently are going to be using to make progress on an issue of mutual concern, strategic warheads and strategic missiles, and trying to reduce their numbers using the old START, I can't even remember what that acronym stands for anymore. It comes from the Reagan era, but it's the last arms control.
Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty.
Right, yeah. Arms Reduction Treaty, exactly. First of all, what do we make of resurrecting START as a way to move forward?
Actually, this is prolonging START. START runs out on December 5th this year. Without it, we would have no agreement. We'd have no inspection, and we'd have no reliability, and security would not be enhanced. So the first stage was, let's prolong START. Then the second stage was, let's combine that with improving START and see if we can reduce war below the 1,700, the 2,200 to 2,000 to 1,700 warheads we agreed to in 1994 in the Moscow Treaty. And so it's really a two-stage effort now combined. The general prognosis is that they will shoot for somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,500, but we don't know until they announce that. And the hope is that that will also result in improving, maybe simplifying, some of the negotiating and some of the complex counting arrangements that take place under START that relate to both warheads and delivery vehicles.
Now, some of the critics of the Obama administration have already described this effort as essentially pulling numbers out of a hat. And John Bolton, the former UN ambassador, had this to say about even getting into the business of reducing strategic nuclear weapons. I wonder if you could react to this. Hold on.
Remember, the Russians don't have any allies that they protect with their nuclear weapons. We have our NATO allies, we have Japan, Australia, and a range of others around the world. Shrinking our nuclear umbrella actually lessens security for many of our friends around the world.
Now, Ambassador Pickering, John Bolton would have us believe that the U.S. nuclear weapons right now are viewed by NATO countries and Japan and Australia as a nuclear umbrella that protects them. Is that your view?
In part it is, but it's passing strange that John should come up with that argument since he led the work at the Moscow Treaty in 1994 to reduce down to 1,700. And to some extent, obviously, lower numbers obviously create different sorts of problems, but that was not his argument. The argument, I think, is fundamentally whether we and the Russians deter each other at lower levels of weapons, and I think the general feeling is that people are reasonably comfortable about this getting down below 1,700. There is now a nuclear posture review going on in the administration to decide basically how some of these particularly difficult questions will be answered over the future. But those who believe, as the president seems to, in moving down towards zero, feel there's a path through this as we move down in numbers. We move down in numbers that are roughly parallel. At the moment, in terms of total weapons, the Russians have more than we do. And so if John is right, then we should be seeking to find equal numbers of weapons over a longer period of time rather than continuing to permit unequal numbers. And that would, in fact, enhance our capacity to deter Russia, and that would, in fact, help us to protect our friends and allies.
Ambassador Pickering, a year ago at this time, we were weeks away from the crisis over Georgia. The Russians invaded. There was harsh language from the then Bush administration. A U.S. election has occurred. The Russians withdrew, and now that's very much in the distance. Do you think that President Medvedev benefits from even standing near Barack Obama, who has a huge international profile way outside of President Medvedev? And does that asymmetry help Obama or hurt him in Russia?
I think it helps the president. It may help President Medvedev, and it may also help Prime Minister Putin, who is a very, very important decision maker in Russia. Perhaps, in the view of many, even still more important than President Medvedev. That particular question of who helps who the most, however, is less relevant, in my view, than what the two can do together. And it appears as if they're going to do something on nuclear disarmament. Let us hope that they can do something as well on missile defense, where the Russians have recently said that while missile defense plays a role in making decisions on disarmament, they're not actually coupling the two in a kind of iron lock so that the United States would either have to give up missile defense or do something else. And in fact, we see some serious interest on the Russian part in cooperative missile defense, something that began under the first George Bush and seemingly never really prospered, but each side continued to have some kind of latent interest in the issue. And the fact that President Obama arriving on the scene with all of his popularity puts him in a very strong negotiating position, in my view, and in a very strong position, in fact, to help move Russia along. And he will give a critical speech during his visit to Moscow to a wide Russian audience that I think will also be one of the critical testing points for this particular visit.
Finally, I want to get your sort of personal reaction to, I guess, what I would call the whipsaw of history. I mean, you were a prominent diplomat at the time when the U.S. and Russia were at Soviet Union were at odds over the situation in Afghanistan. It's likely that there may be some official agreement on cooperation over military cooperation over the situation in Afghanistan. My, how things change.
I think that's right. I think that the U.S., interestingly enough, Russia, and perhaps others like Iran have common interests in Afghanistan. That's not to see al-Qaeda win, not to see the Taliban prosper, to see the government move ahead in a way that is perhaps more broadly accepted than it has been. And while we have gotten permission for NATO to send non-military equipment to Afghanistan through the Russian and the associated transportation system in Central Asia, this new effort may well include also military lethal equipment that's currently not there, and that would, of course, put us closer together. But we have to remember back in 2001 and 2002, when among the first to call President Bush was President Putin, who, in effect, agreed to try to help us establish bases. He thought they would be temporary in Central Asia to support our efforts in dealing with the Taliban in Afghanistan after the 9/11 attack. So there has been some history of this. This is not an entirely new effort, but it looks as if it would mark a period of getting over what diplomats would tend to call the scratchiness of the Bush-Putin period.
Well, to lead to some real regional cooperation, Ambassador Thomas Pickering, former U.S. ambassador to Russia from 89 to 92. Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. Wall Street's open. Looks like all key indices will be seeking new lows, but it's early going. And Mark Garrison has the headlines for this segment.
Thank you, John. Quick headlines at 32 minutes after the hour. Robert McNamara is dead at 93, the Vietnam-era defense secretary. And nukes, of course, are a big topic for President Obama. He's in Russia right now talking about arms reduction. We've been talking about that all morning. You can hear a lot of our conversations and analysis at thetakeaway.org. And back in the U.S., General Motors now has the go-ahead to execute its restructuring plan. A bankruptcy judge approved the plan late last night. night. Four American troops are dead after a roadside bombing in Afghanistan following another deadly blast earlier today in the south. John?
So let's look at her resume. Alaska Governor Sarah Palin has been a hockey mom, right, Mark? A Miss Alaska pageant winner, a vice presidential candidate, and as she reminded us on Friday, she was also a high school point guard.
A good point guard, here's what she does. She drives through a full court press, protecting the ball, keeping her head up because she needs to keep her eye on the basket, and she knows exactly when to pass the ball so that the team can win. And that is what I'm doing, keeping our eye on the ball.
So what is the next step for Governor Palin, who announced her resignation last Friday? Joining us is longtime Alaskan journalist Larry Persily, who is also a former aide to Governor Palin. Larry, thanks so much for joining us from Juneau this morning.
No problem. Good morning.
What are people in Alaska saying about the various metaphors that the governor used in talking about why she was resigning? And really, at the end of the day, we don't have much of a reason. What's the reaction?
Well, I think the initial reaction certainly was shock, surprise. You know, Palin has an amazing ability to do the unexpected, and that's what we saw Friday. In terms of the basketball metaphor, I guess what I'd liken it to is she's like the college star in basketball who junior year looks at the pro market and decides, I'm out of college, I'm going to drop out, I'm going to go at the height of my market, I'm turning pro. And I think that's what she did. She quit because she felt it would be easier not being governor, not putting up with the hassles and a lot of opportunities out there. But nobody knows. Everyone's just walking around all holiday weekend wondering what she's going to do next.
Now, we were talking earlier this hour that possibly, you know, the Mike Huckabee protocol, the get a show on Fox and do some nice interviews on a weekly show is a good place to sort of stay out of the limelight, but possibly still stay in play in some sense for 2012. Is that a plausible scenario for Sarah Palin, and are people talking that
sure,
way?
It's plausible, but I don't think so. You know, I don't think Palin's that good of an interviewer. She doesn't have that good of a grasp of a lot of issues. I don't think she wants to be that overexposed and putting herself out there every day or on a weekly basis like that, I think. And, of course, I'm just guessing here. I don't think her family wants to leave Alaska and move to where you're going to have to be to host a show like that, whether East Coast, West Coast. So I would expect she'll do a lot of speaking at venues where she's comfortable, like we saw in April when she went to the conservative group in Evansville, Indiana. So she'll do public speaking, she'll do outreach, she'll try to get the crowds that love her excited for conservative causes, but she'll be picking her locations.
But Larry, I mean, she could do a fishing show, right?
She could do a fishing show, she could do a hunting show, she could do all that, but I'm guessing
this is a package. This feels like a package, a fishing show, a hunting show, and some Republican fundraising speeches around the country. That's a gig.
It is, and it's going to be an easier gig for her, whatever it is, because she's not being governor. She's not going to have to work at the job every day, make tough choices, be criticized for them, and have people file ethics complaints against her under the ethics laws that exist with state government. She'll just be out there. Again, I think she's going to appeal to the people who love her and stick with those people.
And the FBI apparently was all over itself over the weekend to say, hey, we're not investigating Sarah Palin. There's no speculation there that she's stepping out of the way of some freight train that's coming down the pike here.
Oh, sure, there's speculation, but it's being fed by the bloggers. Let's face it, Palin, no Palin. Unfortunately, bloggers, many of them anonymous, most of them having no training whatsoever, no fact-checking, are driving public policy discussion in this country, and we're getting garbage for it. So aside from that, but generally most Alaskans don't believe there's a scandal coming. They just believe she got tired of it, got tired of the hassles, and she quit her job.
So are you going to run for governor, Larry?
No, I was thinking maybe I should run for lieutenant governor next year because everyone's going to run for governor, so maybe they'll forget about lieutenant governor and I could go in unopposed.
So is the focus this weekend quickly turning to who's next?
It is. People were joking that they're going to have to use both sides of the ballot in 2010. So many people are going to be running for governor on the primary election ballot. It's an open seat. We've had a couple weird ones in there of late. So, yes, there will be easily a dozen people in the two-party primaries.
I mean, this is really a shocker on a couple of levels for the state of Alaska. I mean, all of a sudden, Ted Stevens, poof, is gone. Sarah Palin moves on. I mean, maybe she'll stay in Alaska, as you say, but it looks like very likely that she's off in another realm entirely. You know, what's that like for the state to have its, like, politicians who are so highly visible and so impossible to imagine life without vanish?
Well, you know, we always knew we were a little weird up here, and we like national attention. You know, we liked being the focus of northern exposure, the TV show, the sitcom. But
from the 80s, though, that
yeah,
sitcom, yeah.
And our little 15 minutes of fame as they come along are kind of heartwarming. And this is way more than anyone wanted. Some of us are starting to wonder, is this such a thing as bad publicity?
So basically, we're looking at campaign slogans like, vote for Larry Persily. He's boring.
Right.
Something like that?
That could be, but my guess is I will probably stay out of running for office. But there are going to be a lot of people. We've already had a couple announced over the weekend, and there will be more.
Face it, Larry, you're way too exciting to be Alaska governor for this era. From Juneau, Alaska, Larry Persily, longtime journalist and former aide to Sarah Palin. And, of course, Sarah Palin has resigned. She'll be out at the end of the month looking for the next big thing. We're looking for ideas. What's the plan B for Sarah Palin? Should she run for president? Well, that's one, of course, but host a talk show, maybe star in the sequel to the movie Fargo. She's already got the accent for that.
Hi, this is Maurice. I think Sarah Palin is stepping down because she has plans to become involved in the care of Michael Jackson's kid.
877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
This is Greg from Boston. If you like making fun of Republicans, and who doesn't, then you want Sarah Palin to run every time for anything possible. 2012 will be a fun year.
Come on, you guys. You're branding us as like a partisan sort of, you know, trash the conservatives kind of public radio show, and we can't have that here on The Takeaway. 877-8-MY-TAKE, mytake@thetakeaway.org. Grace writes on our site, we as a nation need to stop giving so much credit to Sarah Palin. Her persona is being fed by the media, and she's eating this up and turning it into more power than she could possibly possess on her own. I think all of us need to let her disappear from focus, and perhaps she will find it much more difficult to find backing in whatever future she plans. Well, Grace, I'm sure Governor Palin will be happy for the good words from you. Again, 877-8-MY-TAKE for your suggestions, mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And first, it was a first service that didn't quite make it. Then it was a second serve and a blown service return. And there was only one thing to say.
And Federer stands alone.
History was made yesterday at Wimbledon. Roger Federer and Andy Roddick squared off at the finals. It was an epic match. Federer finally beat Roddick in five sets, breaking the record for most games in a Wimbledon final.
You threw everything at him, didn't you?
Well, I tried. Sorry, Pete. I know I tried to hold him off.
Poor Andy Roddick talking about holding off Roger Federer's attack on Pete Sampras's record. Now he holds it alone. The other big story at Wimbledon, Serena Williams defeated her sister in her third Wimbledon title and yet another all-Williams final at Wimbledon. Ibrahim and Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributors here in the studio. Wow, that was something.
It was an amazing weekend. I think for the Williams sisters, you have to think about this. What if Tiger Woods had a brother, and every Masters and every U.S. Open they played against each other?
Mickelson thinks about that.
That's the level of dominance that the Williams sisters have.
Yeah, it's really something. And the crowd seemed to be with Venus.
It did. I think she has the air of being the nicer one, the sweeter one, and Serena is a little snarlier, especially when she loses. And so I think definitely a lot of folks were pulling for Venus.
Well, let's listen to here's a little Serena reacting there when she's holding the trophy.
I feel like I shouldn't be holding the trophy. Like, I can't believe I'm holding it in Venus.
Because it's sort of named for Venus, isn't it?
It's named the Venus, and, you know, she always wins, and it's just like, wow. It hasn't settled in that I won yet.
Well, certainly the people in Britain are aware of this history and are used to the Williams sisters coming every year. Federer now, though, is he the best in the world?
That game was 10 games longer than any previous clinching set ever, the fifth set that they played.
Federer had 50 aces.
Correct.
Roddick's serve, even in that last game, was 134 miles an hour.
And Federer only broke him in the 77th game, which was remarkable. And it was the only way that Federer was going to beat him, which actually shows his greatness at this particular moment, because Roddick, at the top of his game, he could not match Federer's skill and his ability to get across the court.
But you knew it. I mean, you knew it watching those last games. He missed that first serve. Roddick missed that first serve. You knew that Federer was going
to
kill him.
And that's where you thought, in the beginning of it, I was like, there's no chance that Roddick has. If he has to go against Federer, then he's definitely going to lose because of the mental factor. Federer's mental preparation for tennis there's no one that's better than him, and Roddick was right there. There was a moment when Roddick sort of slipped, I think it was in the third set, when he kind of slipped and he tumbled over, and actually at that moment I thought Roddick is a little hobbled and is a little injured, and that's when I think he lost it a little bit.
Well, you said that Roddick just has to win, and I thought he did throw absolutely everything at him. I really feel sorry for that guy today.
The moment, actually, the previous moment too, was in the second set tiebreak when Federer was down 6-1. That was the moment that Roddick had to put him away, and he didn't take advantage of that moment.
And on his first championship point, Federer put it away. He's now got 15 championships. Ibrahim Abdelmateen, Takeaway Sports contributor, thanks so much.
Yes, sir.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining the practice of renting dogs to people who desire canine companionship when visiting a new city. Who does it really comfort, and who does it exploit? Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. He was the best and brightest, perhaps, of the best and the brightest who surrounded John F. Kennedy during his presidency. The defense secretary for JFK and Lyndon Johnson is dead. A look at his legacy in just a moment. But first, headlines from Mark Garrison.
Thank you, John. 12 minutes before the hour, President Obama is in Moscow right now, having private chats with Russian President Dmitry Medvedev. Later, there will be meetings with Prime Minister Vladimir Putin. Top of the agenda is nuclear arms reductions. They'll talk about other things as well. A bankruptcy judge rules that General Motors can carry out its restructuring plan, but the ruling could be appealed. That came in a ruling late last night from the judge. Former NFL quarterback Steve McNair was murdered. Nashville police now call his shooting death a homicide, but they aren't yet classifying the death of the woman found shot beside him. On Saturday, they found a gun under her body. At least two are dead in Honduras after clashes between security forces and supporters of the exiled president. Coup leaders blocked his attempt at return flight from landing yesterday. Manuel Zelaya says he'll try again, perhaps today or tomorrow. Four American troops are dead after a roadside bombing in Afghanistan. This follows another deadly blast in that country earlier today in the south. 140 people are dead and hundreds more injured in northwest China. That's according to Chinese state media. The violence is in the wake of a protest by the minority Uyghur population. John?
Thank you, Mark. So former Defense Secretary Robert S. McNamara died today. He was 93. His death happened quietly at his home at 5:30 this morning. His wife, Diana, told the Associated Press he'd been in failing health for some time. But for many, many years, Robert McNamara has been trying to explain his legacy, choices that he made during the Kennedy era and Johnson era that had historical significance for all time.
Any military commander who is honest with himself or with those he's speaking to will admit that he has made mistakes in the application of military power. He's killed people unnecessarily, his own troops or other troops, through mistakes, through errors of judgment.
That's Robert McNamara speaking in the movie all about Robert McNamara by the documentary filmmaker Errol Morris called The Fog of War. We'll have more clips from that film in a moment. But joining us now is Larry Korb, former Assistant Secretary of Defense, who's been a friend of Robert McNamara for quite some time and has worked with him on nuclear weapons policy, something that we should remind our listeners. Robert McNamara was in the middle of the whole Cuban Missile Crisis events in the Kennedy administration. Lawrence Korb, thanks for joining us.
Nice to be with you.
Let's talk first about what McNamara's legacy was with Kennedy and then with Johnson, and then we'll get to the issue of how he's really spent the latter part of his life explaining that in some experiences that have really been really agonizing to watch and experience.
Well, it has. I mean, he was, in fact, they labeled the war in Vietnam McNamara's war for two reasons. One, he was the Secretary of Defense, and he was a person who was very, very controlling in terms of, you know, decisions that were made. The other legacy, of course, that people forget is he was probably the first Secretary of Defense ever to run the department. I mean, previous people had sort of presided. He really ran it and made the decisions in terms of, you know, what weapons we would buy and you know, what kind of forces we would have. And then, of course, that carried over into Vietnam, where he was involved in a lot of the decisions.
Well, Larry Korb, you know, we should remind our listeners again that here was a man who was recruited directly from the presidency of the Ford Motor Company by JFK. His talents as a manager were exactly what Kennedy was looking for to run the Pentagon, yet he is sort of left with this legacy, particularly post-Vietnam, of being something of an ideologue, a zealot. That's exactly what Robert McNamara was not.
No, that's correct. And again, you know, I think if you take a look, when he turned against the war in 66 and tried to tell Johnson, you know, that we ought to get out, but, you know, he was loyal to the president. And by late 66, Johnson had decided to force him out because of the fact that many in Congress were upset that McNamara now was, you know, said the war wasn't working. And, you know, when he left, the American casualties were about 16,000 deaths, you know. We ended up with 58,000, and I think people, forget that. And you're right. I mean, he was brought in to run the Pentagon, and he ran it. And in fact, they still use the same framework that he established for making budgetary decisions every year.
Well, let's listen. This again from the documentary "The Fog of War." Here's Robert McNamara talking about the confrontation with Russia over Cuba.
At the end, we lucked out. It was luck that prevented nuclear war. We came that close. Rational individuals. Kennedy was rational. Khrushchev was rational. Castro was rational. Rational individuals came that close to total destruction of their societies. And that danger exists today.
You know, in many ways, McNamara's struggle and the people who struggled to understand him was about this issue of rationality. In the case of nuclear weapons, rationality won. But McNamara really was accused of using rational arguments, mathematical arguments almost, on the battlefield in Vietnam for extraordinarily brutal human consequences. First, why was he successful on the nuclear side?
Well, he was successful on the nuclear side because he recognized that after you got to a certain number of weapons, it made no sense to keep building. I mean, previous to that, before he came to the Pentagon, they just kept building and building, you know, sort of in a race with the former Soviet Union. He said, you know, when you reach a certain point, it makes no sense to go on, and what we ought to do is work with the Soviet Union to limit the number. And the other is during the Cuban Missile Crisis, you know, he recognized that the stakes were so high that if you took precipitous military action, a lot of our military people wanted to bomb the facility, it could unleash a nuclear war. And we found out later, we didn't know at the time, that Khrushchev had designated to the on-scene commander in Cuba the authority to fire nuclear weapons if the United States invaded. And, you know, I remember talking to him about it once, and he said, when one military officer said, well, if we bomb, we wouldn't get them all, he said, I felt like hugging him because there was such pressure on Kennedy, particularly from what we would today call the hawks in Congress, to do something about, the nuclear weapons 90 miles from the United States.
You know, I watched The Fog of War. It was really the last big kind of look at Robert McNamara for most people. I mean, you had contact with him, up to the end, I'm presuming here.
Yeah, I saw him about 2 months ago.
Sure.
The last time I saw.
Yeah, I got the impression watching The Fog of War that on some level, whether he could make the argument that he acted responsibly in Vietnam, that somehow the numbers failed him, that the attempt to use numbers to measure all things in the Pentagon missed certain things that he felt morally responsible for in some ways.
Well, he did. And if you read his book in retrospect that talks about the mistakes that, we made in Vietnam, he does admit there, one of the lessons he says, we fail to recognize the limitations of modern high technology military equipment, confronting an unconventional, highly motivated enemy. In other words, the body counts were all in our favor, but that, that was not breaking the will of the Vietnamese.
So here's one final clip from that movie, The Fog of War.
But he hasn't destroyed nations. And the conventional wisdom is don't make the same mistake twice. Learn from your mistakes. And we all do.
In the end, a long life of learning from mistakes is perhaps the most profound, I think, lesson that McNamara passes on. I was really ultimately admiring of his candor. As I looked at him over the last several years.
Well, I agree. And I can't remember a public official with the courage to confess error and explain where the country went wrong. I mean, it'll be interesting to see, Secretary Rumsfeld writes a book and, explains, his errors. I mean, and it bothered him for the rest of his life. I mean, people forget that after he left the Pentagon in 67, he ran the World Bank and really did an awful lot in terms of dealing with poverty and hunger around the world. And then he dedicated, the rest of his life to trying to do something about, this proliferation of nuclear weapons, but it's all been lost because of, the Vietnam era.
You know, there's a famous television clip, I believe, of Robert McNamara addressing the Kennedy assassination when he was long ensconced in the Johnson administration, and he broke down and cried. And I believe Errol Morris asked him the same question decades later, and he still broke down and cried. Do you think the Kennedy assassination, in some sense, was devastating, unrecoverably devastating for Robert McNamara?
It was, because he had a very good relationship with President Kennedy, and he really, I use the term worshipped him. Johnson was more, a professional thing, and I always got the impression that he would like not to have, stayed on under Johnson, but Johnson asked him, and I asked him one time, and he said, well, I had a duty, I was asked to stay on. The country was going through turmoil. My own personal opinion, I told him, and I also told my boss, Weinberg, when I was working for him, that don't stay longer than 4 years, because every secretary who has not turned out well.
Well, Lawrence Korb, former Assistant Secretary of Defense, talking about the death today of Robert McNamara, longest-serving defense secretary, who died today at 93. Thank you, Larry, and this is
Thanks
The Takeaway.
For having me.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE. Or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.